It's about 1:37 in the afternoon of Wednesday, February. Kind of look at my glasses now. 13th, and we 2008. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Terrio is here. Senator McGuire, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. We're here today to get a briefing from the Department of Law on a case titled ExxonMobil versus the State of Alaska. It's about the Point Thompson unit, specifically about the commissioner of Department of Revenues, or I'm sorry, Natural Resources, rejection of the 22nd plan of development filed by Exxon and the termination of the Point Thompson unit. It's a fairly complex piece of litigation, and so I wanted to get the department to come and tell us about sort of what the history of the case is, what happened in court back in December when the state won a big victory, I believe, in the case, as well as what may happen in the future. The department's a little bit nervous about testifying here today, and I want to just try to put them at ease. It is a piece of ongoing litigation. I have kind of given them sort of carte blanche to turn aside any questions that they feel may sort of impinge on their future tactics, strategy, and planning, and so forth. And so I want them to not put the case in any danger whatsoever, and to be, you know, err on the side of caution, if you will, in the answering of questions. But it is a big issue. It does have, I think, some impact on the future of the gas line and development of a gas supply to market here in the state of Alaska. And so that's why we're having the hearing today. And let me just begin by thanking the Department of Law for the huge amount of work they put in to this. I don't know, as I page through the documents and the briefings and so forth, you see references to 5,000-page filings and 3,000-page filings. I mean, the paperwork involved in this case has been enormous. It has been a 30-year struggle. And so I just want to thank the department and the good public servants that are working day in and day out to look after the interests of Alaskans in this matter. So with that, I will invite up the Department of Law. I think there are some folks here who want to make a presentation to us. Mr. Todd, nice to see you. Mr. Tillery, welcome to the committee. Please put yourselves on the record, and you can begin wherever you want to begin.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Richard Todd. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Alaska Department of Law, and I'm lead counsel for the Point Thompson litigation. I was asked to come here today to brief the committee on the December 26, 2007 Superior Court decision on the appeals from the Point Thompson unit termination. If it would please the chairman, I'd proceed with that at this
please
time.
Please do.
I think it makes sense to start before actually getting into the decision to give you some background information on oil and gas leasing and some facts about the Point Thompson unit. This litigation is about the Point Thompson unit, and an oil and gas unit is an agreement to develop two or more leases together. And the purpose of unitization is to affect efficient production. Rather than having to develop each lease separately, you can do it jointly and realize economies of scale, et cetera. A unit is formed when DNR approves an agreement to by the lessees of the leases that will make up the unit to operate together, and a proposed plan for operation of the unit and other documents that are submitted. If the unit is approved and the lessees drill a well which is capable of producing and paying quantities, the unit will continue indefinitely, so long as it is operating under a plan approved by the Department of Natural Resources. In contrast, an oil and gas lease is typically issued for a fixed term. That term is usually 10 years, but it could be another time period, usually shorter. And that lease will expire at the end of that fixed term unless the lessee has met one of the conditions for extension of the term. One such condition which will allow extension of the term of the lease is production. If it's in production at the end of its primary term, it will not automatically terminate, and generally speaking, the lease will continue so long as there is production. Another condition that will extend the term of a lease is unitization. If the lease is committed to a unit, it does not expire at the end of its primary term, and the lease will continue so long as the unit is in good standing. Here are some relevant facts about the Point Thompson unit. It was formed 31 years ago in 1977. It's made up of approximately 45 state oil and gas leases consisting of more than 100,000 acres. Nearly all the leases in the unit are beyond their primary term. I think there's two that are not. Some of the leases were issued in 1965, so they've been in existence for 45 years with an initial primary term of 10 years, and they've never produced. They've never been put in commercial production. In the 1970s, oil was discovered in the Point Thompson unit. By the early 1980s, gas deposits and additional oil deposits were discovered. There's at least 200 million barrels of oil in the Point Thompson unit Brookian formations, and there's 8 trillion cubic feet of gas, and additional and hundreds of millions of barrels of gas condensate and oil in the Point Thompson sand reservoir. Point Thompson is one of the largest undeveloped natural gas fields in North America, but it has never been put into production. It's never produced hydrocarbons. The AOGCC, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and DNR agree that the unit has not been adequately explored or delineated, and that more exploration wells are needed. Here are some facts about the proceedings that occurred before DNR, before this case was appealed by the lessees to the Superior Court. And on October 27, 2005, the DNR Director of Oil and Gas rejected the lessee's proposed 22nd plan of development because it failed to meet the requirements of the unit agreement and the regulations, and because the lessees had failed to commit to put the unit in production. After all these years, they still couldn't find a way forward to produce the unit, produce these hundreds of millions of barrels of hydrocarbons. DNR gave the lessees approximately 1 year to cure this problem by submitting a plan which met the requirements of the unit agreement and the regulations, and that committed to develop this unit. DNR also wanted more exploration wells and adequate delineation of the reservoirs that were known to exist. The director stated in that decision that if the lessees failed to submit an acceptable plan of development, one that met the applicable standards, that the unit was subject to termination. Excuse me. The lessees had previously refused DNR's repeated requests to drill additional exploration wells and delineation wells and to put the unit into production. So that decision was issued against the backdrop of the decades-old contest between DNR and the lessees, with DNR trying to get the lessees to fulfill their development obligations and the lessees essentially refusing, saying they didn't have to.
Mr. Todd, let me just stop you there, because one of the things that struck me as I read the briefings about this sort of standoff was the lessees, Exxon is the lessee, I take it, the lessees sort of position that they couldn't develop this field until there was a gas pipeline. That appears in several points of the briefing, and I'm just making note of that because it just struck me as being unusual since we've heard over and over that the we need to have a supply of gas to fill this gas pipeline, and yet the position here was that it couldn't even be developed until there was a gas pipeline, and that's a little unusual, at least from my limited perspective in the oil industry, because what you typically do is you produce oil and recycle gas to maintain reservoir pressure, and then and yet in this case they were saying no, they needed to do a blowdown, they needed to relieve gas pressure by flowing a bunch of gas first to a gas pipeline, and from my read of the briefings, it was the AOGCC's position that would lead to waste, that you could leave tens of millions of barrels of gas and gas condensate in the ground if you did this blowdown method. Is my layman's sort of understanding about right as far as the legal arguments went?
Mr. Chairman, I have to say, Senator French, I have to say that much of what you've just asked me I would have to leave to DNR, but I will say this, that you've touched on a lot of the points you've made, I think, are supported by the record, and I would put it this way, because I think I can put it this way. In 1982, after the unit had been in existence for 5 years and a number of wells, exploration wells, had been drilled in the unit and these major hydrocarbon deposits had been discovered, The lessees submitted a plan of development. I can't remember what this was, the sixth or the eighth, and they basically said they wanted to go into a five-year study program. They didn't want to drill any more wells. They didn't want to do any actual on-the-ground work. They just basically wanted to do studies about potential development. DNR was very concerned. They issued, you know, documents they're referred to in the appeal briefs that said, gee, this is deficient. We all know we want you to better delineate these reservoirs so that we can put them in production. We want you to make a commitment to put this unit into production, start producing these hydrocarbons. At that point in time, the lessee, this was 1982, the lessee said, we're not going to put this unit into production until there's a gas liner. We do not, it'd be a waste of time to put this unit into production until there's a gas line. Now, there's a real fallacy with that argument. It's a fundamental proposition. And that is this: you don't need a gas line to produce oil. There's hundreds of millions of barrels of oil in this unit. And, you know, I'm not an engineer, and I don't want to get on a limb, but I'll basically tell you this. This unit's approximately 30 miles from Madami. It would seem to me there's a way to do this, to produce the oil, without having a gas line. There are significant quantities of gas condensates in this unit. It's a very complicated engineering exercise, but essentially, as opposed to the gas blowdown which you've described, you could do a different type of development in which you produce liquids and gas together, strip the liquids, ship them down a line, and reinject the dry gas into the reservoir to maintain reservoir pressure. If you don't do that, you also alluded to the possibility of waste with a gas blowdown project. The problem is that this reservoir is under extremely high pressure. You know, different things you read, it has different numbers, but generally it's between 10 and 13,000 PSI. If you simply plug a hole in that, put a hole in that reservoir and start producing everything, the reservoir pressure drops, you're going to lose liquids. A significant amount of liquids will become unrecoverable. And so what you want to do is cycle first. I'm not saying that this is the only way to do it. I'm just, you know, if you cycle first and recover the optimum number of amount of liquids, you can then switch to a gas blowdown, but you don't start with a gas blowdown necessarily. However, this is all dependent on a lot of unknowns because we don't have sufficient exploration and delineation wells to actually to be certain about a lot of this stuff. And again, that's one thing that AOGCC and DNR agree on. There's been insufficient delineation wells drilled, and all the agencies involved in this want more wells so that we have better data and better decisions can be made. So there is a risk with a gas blowdown project of loss of liquids. Oil could be produced, I believe, or if my understanding is, without incurring that risk, at least if they come from the Brookian formations as opposed to the Point Thompson. But this is really a more appropriate question for a representative of DNR.
Sure. But just from and Senator McGuire has a question.
Probably not going to be able to answer it, but perhaps Mr. Tillery could. Besides the legal facts, what's the theory that the state has adopted as to why ExxonMobil would be sitting on such economic prospects with respect to oil, as you describe in the one case, and gas, and not make those good faith efforts to develop it?
Mr. Chairman.
If you'd identify yourself, Mr. Tillery.
Craig Tillery, the Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law. I've actually kind of wondered about that myself, but that is a question. It really is a DNR question, and frankly, it's not even a DNR question. That's a producer's question. You need to ask them what their motivations are. Anything we would say would sort of be speculation, and it would pretty much be inappropriate for me to do that.
Follow up.
And just on that point, I would assume that the state, well, I would think that the state would be gathering or have gathered evidence of other business prospects that the company has and how they walked through those developments as a comparison. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud. Or is it just that clear analysis saying, you know, have you made those good faith efforts? Have you looked around to see what the company has done in other places?
I have to, Senator McGuire, through the chairman, I have to say that I live in a very limited world as far as these issues are concerned. My concern isn't really on the issues that you're addressing. what is on our plate is a situation where the agency believes that the lessees are not complying with the applicable agreements, regulations, and other laws. And so if they're taking action, they're taking action to try and affect production, to try and get these lessees to produce. And so for me and from my perspective, my sort of world is the laws, the statutes, the facts that relate to this particular unit, and it's not really germane to what I do to go and look into the type of things you're inquiring about. But
it is worth pointing out, though, that I think you mentioned that the Badami pipeline is some 30 miles away physically from where this unit's boundaries are. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Chairman.
Thank you. And further
sitting,
questions?
Sitting empty.
Sitting empty, according to Senatorio. Yeah.
Would it, Mr. Chairman, would you like me to continue?
Please proceed, yeah.
Okay, so the director rejected the 22nd POD because it proposed additional studies, and we've been in studies for many, many years, and gave the lessees approximately a year. The initial director's decision gave them 90 days. The commissioner extended that to where they had approximately 1 year to submit a plan which met the requirements of the regulations. Go ahead.
And let me just ask you a question about the timeline. Did the termination of the unit decision get made at the same time that the 22nd POD was rejected, or was that subsequent?
No, it was not rejected at that time. However, the last finding in the director's decision was that if the lessees failed to submit an acceptable POD, that the unit was subject to termination. And throughout that decision, the director alludes to such things as, you know, the state's remedy. When you have, he doesn't say it exactly this way, but generally the message is state's remedy when it has a producer that will not, a lessee that will not develop and produce, is to take the property back, make it available for other potential bidders who may have a different perspective on the desirability of this development, and they may, you know, require a lower rate of return. The state may be able to get it to production. That is generally the state's remedy.
And these initial decisions were being made at the director level, not at the commissioner level. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay. Mark Myers, who is the director at the
person
time,
at the time
of the initial decision, then he left along with a number of other people from DNR, and I believe Bill Van Dyke issued the second decision.
I see. Thank you.
So at any rate, they were given a year to submit a plan of development which met the requirements of the regulations, and the director included an example of an acceptable plan of development. November 3, 2006, thousands of pages of documents were filed with DNR, including a proposed modified 22nd plan of development. This plan of development was in many respects very similar. The commissioner expressly found that it suffered from the same defects as the initial plan of development. There was no commitment to produce. It was actually a little bit worse because the initial plan of development was for 1 year, and so DNR would have a chance 12 months after approval of that POD to see how they were doing. When November 3rd, the lessees proposed a 5-year plan of development. And so at any rate, that's sort of a side point. The commissioner rejected the 22nd POD, the modified one that was submitted November 3, 2006. He affirmed the commissioner, the director's rejection of the initial 22nd POD, and he decided that the appropriate course of action was to take against the background of the history of this unit in this contest, was to terminate the unit. And so he did so. Several of the lessees, ExxonMobil and I believe ConocoPhillips, filed a motion for reconsideration. By the time it was ripe for decision, Commissioner Menge had left, and Acting Commissioner Marty Rutherford affirmed Commissioner Menge's decision. From there, the lessees appealed to the Superior Court, and they made, I can't hit every single argument they raised, but generally speaking, their arguments to the court were that the state could only terminate this unit through court proceedings. And so the decision had to be set aside because the termination came administratively. The lessees took the position that DNR was without power to require them to do anything unless DNR could show that a reasonably hypothetical, reasonably prudent operator would do what DNR asked. The lessees asserted that the decision violated the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. The lessees also argued that the unit continued in perpetuity forever once they discovered a reservoir that was capable of producing and paying quantities. They made this argument based on the unit language.
With or without production? Simply the discovery of,
yeah.
of a known,
yes,
a commercial discovery. Quantity of oil would preserve that unit forever?
Yes.
Wow. Senator McGuire has a question.
On that point, through the chair, could you cite the specific language in that agreement that they were alluding to in the lease?
I believe it.
That allowed for perpetuity? If you can't put your finger on it right
McGuire,
now.
Senator McGuire, through the chairman, I can. Point. I think I can, but, you know, this may
take
be
a moment. Take a
several
moment.
Pages. I believe it was Article 20 of the unit agreement. This is a fairly complex legal proposition. There's a clause in most leases and in unit agreements called a habendum clause, and what it is really the grant. If you go back in real property law, there's a clause in, say, a deed, which it discusses what you're getting in this deed. Is it a quitclaim? Is it a warranty deed? Is it an easement? What is it? And so a habendum clause is sort of like that. It's kind of like a grant. And so this habendum clause, it's, let me see here. I think I've got the unit agreement with me. I can't remember how long this section is.
Okay, this is fascinating to me, though.
Isn't, yep. Yeah, let's take our time.
Okay. Well, Section 20 is, well, let me see if I can find this language. Okay, so Section 20 begins. Effective date and term. The agreement should, and it reads as follows. The agreement shall become effective upon approval by the commissioners or his authorized representative as of the date of approval by the commissioner and shall terminate 5 years from said effective date unless. Now I'll try and go to the key language. I believe it's subsection C, and it says, a valuable discovery of unitized substances has been made or accepted on unitized land in said initial term or any extension thereof in which the agreement shall remain in effect. I apologize for this. This document was written in 1977, so fortunately, lawyers write differently today.
We won't hold you to the, we won't hold you to the language, Mr.
Okay, I can just run through it here, and so I can just read it, and then we'll talk about it if that's acceptable to you.
Absolutely.
Okay. A valuable discovery of unitized substances has been made or accepted on unitized land during said initial term or any extension thereof, in which the agreement shall remain in effect for such term and so long as unitized substances can be produced in quantities sufficient to pay for the cost of producing same from wells on unitized land, and should production cease, so long thereafter as diligent operations are in progress for the restoration of production or discovery of new production, and so long thereafter as unitized substances so discovered can be produced as aforesaid. So basically, mm-hmm. I believe the spin on that argument is we discovered a reservoir. Mm-hmm. We discovered huge reservoirs. They're capable of producing at a commercial level, and they can be produced. We could produce mm-hmm. them. And so since we've discovered this and we can produce it, we've created this valuable property right by discovering this reservoir, and you can't take it away from us unless you can show it can't be produced.
Got it.
At any rate, shall I proceed, Mr.
Please. Norman?
Okay, so the next argument that was raised in court was, well, I guess that's the last of the key arguments that I was pointing out they raised in court. Termination by court, not administrative, reasonably prudent operator standard, violation of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, unit continues in perpetuity. So here's the key arguments that we made on behalf of the Department of Natural Resources. The DNR has a constitutional and statutory responsibility to manage state resources in the public interest. the purpose of unitization is to affect efficient production. If you're not going to produce, the unit should be terminated. Continued existence of the unit is contingent on a plan of development which meets the requirements of the regulations in the unit agreement and which is approved as sufficient by DNR. DNR also argued that it does not have to meet the reasonably prudent operator standard before rejecting the POD, before rejecting a POD that does not otherwise meet the requirements of the law and the unit agreement. If DNR were to accept, if the court were to accept the proposition that we have to meet the reasonably prudent operator standard in evaluating the acceptability of the POD, it would work a transfer of management of state resources from DNR to the lessees. On December 26, 2007, the court issued a decision on this appeal, and this is a summary, but basically here's what she found. She affirmed DNR's rejection of the 22nd POD. She affirmed that DNR has the authority to evaluate the acceptability of a POD. She rejected the lessee's argument that the reasonably prudent operator standard was the standard to apply an evaluation of a POD. She rejected the lessee's allegations that DNR had acted in bad faith in these decisions. She implicitly rejected the lessee's contention that the unit continues indefinitely once a commercial reservoir is discovered. She rejected lessee's argument that termination of a unit must be made by judicial proceedings where the termination is based on the failure to submit an acceptable POD. She agreed with the lessees on the proposition that they had not received sufficient notice that the unit was subject to termination if they failed to accept, submit an acceptable POD. She remanded the case to DNR to give the lessees an opportunity to tell DNR what they think it should do. What is the appropriate remedy for failure to submit an acceptable POD? And I believe implicitly also to tell DNR why they think unit termination is not the appropriate remedy. Those proceedings are pending before DNR now. Currently, there's been some extensions of time. The briefing on that issue on appropriate remedy is due February 19th, and hearing on appropriate remedy is set for March 3.
And that's before the commissioner?
Yes. It is an administrative proceeding before the commissioner. Now, I would characterize this.
Sorry. Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Just want to make sure I understand this. The judge found that she remanded it because she found that the lessees, meaning Exxon and the other producers, weren't aware that their lease could be terminated?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chairman, they can be characterized a lot of ways. Here's the way I would put it. When it comes to due process, the court is king. If the court says insufficient notice of unit termination, the most appropriate course of action is to give the notice and listen to the argument. Essentially, she found that they had received insufficient notice that the unit was subject to termination for failure. And you know, that may be, this is my read on it, and maybe that's not quite right. Maybe she's talking about she wanted more process, more than just a statement in the director's decision that said, if you do not submit an acceptable POD, then the unit is subject to termination. But I'm speculating. I do think it is within the realm of reasonable speculation, though, to say that what she was saying is she wanted more process. She wanted a hearing. She wanted briefing on remedy. That's not I probably said more than enough.
I guess
Senator Wilikowski.
I just find that a very odd ruling because people in Alaska have been talking about terminating that lease for years. And to say that they weren't aware that that was a possibility of happening, I just find very odd.
I'll just say, for the purpose of the record, the judge's rationale is found at pages 41 and 42 of the decision on appeal that has been supplied to the committee. I think the copy's outside. The judge said, while the court has concluded that the Point Thompson unit and then existing regulations did not preclude DNR from pursuing termination at the administrative level, appellants were constitutionally entitled to clear written notice that DNR was considering this remedy when it rejected the POD. And then goes on to explain what should happen next. Senator Terrio.
Well, I'm just wondering if you have an opinion on whether, in fact, the judge was just trying to make sure that the due process, sensitivity to due process of the Supreme Court will ultimately be satisfied. And I know I've heard criticisms of the court that the Alaska Supreme Court really bends over backwards to make sure that everybody got adequate notice. Everybody absolutely knew what was going to happen. I mean, if you're renting an apartment, you know, if you don't pay your rent, it seems to me that the landlord has the right to evict you. And I know the Supreme Court has bent over backwards to make sure that even the renter who's not paying rent and hasn't paid rent for a while, you know, got the adequate notice. And, you know, and so I'm just wondering if you have an opinion whether the judge is making sure that on appeal that, you know, things have been done in a way that will ultimately satisfy the Supreme Court.
Senator Terrio, through the chairman, all I can really say about that is, and this is going to sound political, but I mean, we have an excellent bench in Alaska, and Judge Gleason is an excellent judge, and she made a ruling, she made a call on due process that she felt it was appropriate, and we're complying with that decision. I can't really speculate. No, actually, I think I have to say that what she was doing was applying the law as she sees it, and that would be my answer. I can't really say anything else on that.
Fair to say, though, I mean, just that we won on four big issues and got hung up, if you will, on a procedural question of whether there had been, you know, perfect notice, perfect written notice to the other side.
Chairman, I, you know, okay, it's my case, but it was a fabulous victory. And I shouldn't say it was my case. There's a lot of other people working on this case. I'm lead counsel for the Department of Law, but the law firm of Ashburn and Mason, Mark Ashburn, Danny Crosby, Matt Finley have all worked very hard on this. John Kachin at the Attorney General's office, Jeff Landry. It has been a team effort. And so, but having said that, it was a great victory. It was a great victory. We won every major point except this procedural issue on due process. So I think it was a great vindication for DNR, and it's a very good indication that they're on the right course, and that Commissioner Menge started, made the right, at least is trying to do the right thing here.
Senator McGuire has a question.
Well, I just more comment. I think when you read it, you could read it both ways, but I do think that whether it's the judicial branch or the legislative branch speaking, or the executive branch for that matter, I mean, when we are partnering with the private sector and others, we do want to be clear. And I think that the point that is made that, you know, when we're rejecting your plan of development, this is what it could mean, is an important point to make. And I think we want the folks that are, you know, considering developing here in Alaska to understand those things very clearly. So I'm not troubled by the rejection on that point, because I think it will make our laws better. I think it'll make our process better, and able to, you know, stand all of the appropriate criticisms out there. So I look forward to the result. But I think the more clear we can be, the more direction we can give, so that people understand, you know, when you have an obligation to develop these leases and there are consequences. And when you submit these plans, if it's rejected, I mean, the very real consequence could be that we're going to take this away from you and give someone else an opportunity to develop a resource.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Tillery.
If I can just add one thing. I certainly agree this is an unqualified success, and we're very proud of the work that the Department of Law and our outside counsel did on this case. But I deal with a lot of these cases with a lot of agencies and a lot of lawyers throughout government, and one thing is very clear to me is that our legal work is really only as strong as the agency work that we're defending, and we would be remiss if we didn't point out what a tremendous job DNR has done in this matter.
I'm glad you brought that up, and it actually gives me a moment to gives me, I guess, a moment to have a little mea culpa. Over the years, I was a fairly aggressive critic, I guess, of the former administration's handling of oil and gas matters. But I was reading through the briefing here, and I came upon some language that Mr. Menge wrote when he put his initial decision out, and it's on page 25 of one of your briefs, and I just want to put it in the record. He's talking about Exxon. He says Exxon's economics, their adequate returns, and their risk might be appropriate considerations in some situations, but they play no role here where the unit has been in existence since 1977. Massive hydrocarbon deposits were discovered in the early 1980s. The unit has never been put into production, and the lessees say that it may never be put into production until a gas pipeline is constructed and the state compromises its taxes and royalties. Against this backdrop, the state oil and gas leasing system is not intended to require DNR to engage in murky, and I had to chuckle to myself at his choice of the use of that word, subjective contest is to not engage in a murky, subjective contest about a lessee's internal economics, development risk, or view of the difficulty of developing the unit. One of the state's primary interests is production. If production is not in the plan, the state's remedy is to terminate the unit and find another means to develop the unit. And I just thought that was good, strong language from a commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources doing his job.
Would you like?
Please, Steve.
So Judge Gleason remanded for additional proceedings on remedies. She's asked DNR to render a decision and be back in court, have it back before her by June 15, 2008. Currently, I may have mentioned this before, briefing scheduled for February 19th, hearing scheduled for March 3rd, and those proceedings are pending. The commissioner, the commissioner will decide the appropriate remedy after hearing out the lessees on their recommendations, their briefing. Overall perspective, we believe that we will be back in court by June 2008, that the judge will decide no later than the end of the year, possibly earlier than that, and that we will hopefully be through the Alaska Supreme Court by 2010-2011. And that's my presentation.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee for Mr. Todd or Mr. Tillery? Let me just ask you about the future. You mentioned that you would be back in front of the judge, so that presupposes a decision on the merits by the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources sometime between now and say when.
Yes, it does, Mr. Chairman.
And when would be sort of the outer bounds of when you expect that decision from the commissioner?
I think the commissioner is going to issue that decision when he feels he's ready. And so I can tell you this, we'll have a hearing March 3rd that gives some time, a couple of months before he needs to be back in court, and I just don't know. I can't say when he'll be ready to do that.
But do you expect to be back in front of the judge by June 2008?
Yes, June of this year.
Okay. Senator McGuire.
He's not going to be able to answer the question.
Okay.
I would love to hear what the remedies are that are being discussed, but I mean, can you?
No,
his boss just said no.
All the questions I want answered, you can't answer.
I do have one question about the decision. On page 42 of the court's decision, there'd been a lengthy discussion of Section 10 of the PTUA, of Section 20C, and yet on page 42 it says, on remand, the agency should also consider the import of Section 21 as amended in 1985 and determining the appropriate remedy. This kind of goes to the question that Senator McGuire was posing. Could you maybe just give us a synopsis of what's in Section 21 so we have some idea of what the agency will have in its mind?
Well, this is, Mr. Chairman, this is an issue which is in litigation right now, and so I don't really want to say a lot about it, but generally speaking, at the time the unit was formed, there's a statute which I believe said that the commissioner could include a provision giving him in a unit agreement or release, giving him the authority to change the rate of production, et cetera. And so the Article 21 is a provision which provides for procedures for changing the rate of prospecting or production. And There's so much I could say, and I just don't think I should write at this time.
Fair enough.
That's the topic.
Fair enough. I've promised not to push you into an area where you're uncomfortable, and so we'll go ahead and honor that. There is, you know, I mean, I guess for the public, though, it is worth, you know, just talking about the idea that, you know, should the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Law prevail, ultimately what you would see is the leases, you know, the unit being terminated and the leases being, you know, reoffered at a public auction, just like any other lease. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I think that is true with some of the leases. It's not necessarily true of all the leases. There's a lot of ins and outs here. Once you get to the leases, it's more of a case-by-case analysis. But generally speaking, yes.
It's a truism that the...
But, well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's important to note that termination, again, is a decision that's in front of DNR right now. I mean, it's...
Correct. I'm just saying, presupposing, you know...
But I understood the premise of your question to be assuming we prevail, and DNR is not at this point in a position of trying to prevail there. They're in an adjudicatory position.
I understand. So I was two steps ahead. Assuming they make that decision, assuming that decision's upheld, then you'd have a place where 8 trillion cubic feet of gas and several hundred million barrels of oil might come back on the market.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's important at this point to say that we don't actually, at this point in time, know what the remedy will be. I mean, there's a possibility that the lessees will come to DNR with a proposal that allows this case to be resolved. There's a possibility that they will make a pitch for remedy on remand that the commissioner finds acceptable and allows them to continue the leases. There's a chance that Judge Gleason will issue a decision after we go back to court, which the parties will find acceptable. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities out there, and so at this point in time, I don't know what the commissioner is going to do. We don't know that termination is going to be pursued.
Fair enough. And in the highly unlikely event that you just come and seek my advice about what to do in that resolution, I would say that I hope it would come with a big stern, you know, a message that says this gas must be sold into an Alaska gas pipeline. Senator Terrio has a question.
The issue of having to look at each lease case by case, how much of that hinges on the issue of whether, in fact, there was a well that was determined or could be determined to have been capable of production?
Senator Terrio, through the chairman, that is one of the issues that is in the pending administrative proceedings for decision. It's one of the things that will be looked at. It is a factor. It is an issue. And there's many other issues that not necessarily as weighty, but some of these leases were expansion leases that came in during the 2001 unit expansion, and their termination isn't contingent on these other proceedings. They're sort of a standalone group of about 15 leases.
And Mr. Chairman, is it true that I guess I always thought about this as sort of the core acreage and then the expansion. Has the expansion acreage all come back to state control and there's no pending issues there and it's really a case about the core acreage now?
Senator Terrio, through the chairman, all the lease termination decisions are on appeal to the commissioner, okay, including the expansion acreage, all the leases that were in existence at the time of the termination.
Okay, I'm sorry, I thought there was some acreage that determination had been made and there was no appeal by the companies. Is that not true?
Senator Terrio, through the chairman, these companies don't all act the same way. Mm-hmm. Some of them drop issues. Some of them continue issues. List pendants have been filed on the leases. A lot of some of the list pendants have been withdrawn by some of the companies on the expansion acreage. Claims regarding the expansion acreage have been dropped. But it's too uncertain right now to say definitively that we've got them back yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
When I see that we've got in this case, 30 years we've been waiting for development, and I'm sure we've got other units out there that we've been waiting a long time for development. Do you see any legislative action that we need to take to try to either spur development that should be occurring or to tighten up our lease language so that we're not stuck in this ongoing process of endless litigation to get our resources developed?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chairman, I'm not authorized to speak about proposed legislation. I'm happy to work on it, but and I'm not actually, you know, I would say as a general proposition, the answer to your question is yes, but I haven't thought about it. I haven't been authorized to work on it. I certainly haven't been authorized to talk to the legislature about it. So in time, if my administration wants me to work on it, I certainly could respond to that.
Follow up?
Yeah, and I'm sure there's administration people out there watching. you know, this is something that's, I think, of critical importance. And perhaps we should make this a priority. Thank you for your... And I'm sure, you know, this is such complex, this is very complex. And you obviously, having delved in, you know this topic much better than any of us do. Any insight you have, I'm sure, would be very helpful to the state.
Senator McGuire is next.
Yeah, through the chair, and on that point to Mr. Tillery, really, I think it would be, it'd really be nice to see the Department of Law work with the Department of Natural Resources on recommendations after this is resolved. I mean, my concern would be that if we were to pass legislation or even speak to the point of what a lease should have in its terms, that we might in some way be weakening the leases that we do have right now. But I remember a briefing memo from Spencer Hosey that came out a couple years ago, and there are some examples of other jurisdictions that use lease language that's pretty absolute. It's not, there's no wiggle room, it's very clear. So I guess, following up on Senator Wilkowski, I would like to see, at whatever point is appropriate, a proposal or some thought given by the Department of Law with Department of Natural Resources on what a lease should look like that wouldn't end in litigation.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I certainly agree with you, not only the potential legislation, but we should have an ongoing re-review of leases in light of incidents and matters that come up to make sure that within the existing legislation we can be as clear and tight as possible to try to limit litigation.
Senator Terrio?
Thank you. I want to, Senator Wilkowski said, you know, we want to hopefully avoid this endless litigation, but I guess from my view, this is not endless litigation. I mean, you talked about an end decision date out of the Supreme Court, and I'm not sure, did you say 2010, 2011, and you know, it's 2008. So it's endless if you never start the process. And you know, I am thankful that the administration under the Murkowski, you know, the Murkowski administration started the process. You certainly, even if you have legal rights, if you never move to exercise them, you might as well not have them at all. And of course, under the terms of the lease, both sides have legal rights. So I guess I've never considered it to be endless litigation, nor have I even considered it to be trying to get production necessarily by ultimately seizing the acreage. As you indicated, the state can reach a settlement with the leaseholders at any time. And I think that's more likely to happen than ultimately the state taking the acreage back and releasing it. So we'll just see how things play out. This committee in the past has passed language. It was a resolution that was supportive, made supportive statements on behalf of the legislative branch of government for this action that's playing out between the executive branch of government being played out in the judicial branch of government. But that never, it wasn't ultimately passed. And I'm just wondering if you see any benefit from the legislative branch of government actually taking the step of making a positive statement about the executive asserting its rights under the lease and doing it in the legal branch of government, if that's what we have to do. mean, I don't think that that necessarily sways the judge, but do you see some positive benefit if the legislature actually went on record in making a supportive statement to the legal proceeding that you're engaged in?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Theriault, I certainly think it's always appreciated when the legislature indicates that they support positions of the administration. I do not believe that it will have an effect on the court. That is simply not something that they would take cognizance of, in my view.
Yeah, and in my opinion, nor should the court be swayed by that. But I you know, take your suggestion that it's, you always like to have support of the branch of government.
I think it's always, excuse me, Senator Terry, I think it's always good for the people to know that the state, the government, is sort of united in their views.
Thank you.
Senator Willikowski had a question.
On the topic of endless litigation, the state litigation is going to end in 2010, you're predicting. That doesn't prohibit them from going ahead and file with the federal district court, does it? They could claim constitutional violations. They could take this all the way up to the Court of Appeals, Ninth Circuit. They could take it up to the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, there is the potential that this couldn't go on for years and years. Is that fair to say?
Senator Willikowski, through the chairman, I can't predict the future. I think that it would be unreasonable for me to say, well, no, there's no chance of that happening. I think it's very unlikely, but we don't actually know what the court will do. They certainly could, as you correctly pointed out, if they raise a constitutional question, potentially they could get a federal court to look at it. However, you know, state courts are competent to decide questions of federal constitutional law. But if, you know, who knows what they're going to say and how the court's going to perceive it. I mean, it's a possibility.
Let me use that as a springboard to maybe a more fundamental question, and that is, you know, describe, if you will, just for us, the size of your legal team. How many lawyers do you have working on this case?
Well, we have six, and we've had six for about, about February of 2007, started expanding the team. We have law firm of Ashburn & Mason. Mark Ashburn is lead counsel. He and I are sort of co-counseling this case. We have a lot of great debates. Danny Crosby, who... She is an excellent trial attorney, very hardworking, excellent writer, who's sort of second in command over at Ashburn & Mason, and Matt Finley, who's a brain trust, I would say, who's junior there. And then in our office, we are fortunate enough to have John Kachin, who's a young attorney, a very brilliant attorney, extremely hardworking, often works weekends and nights, and Jeff Landry, who's he's got gray hair also. He's a very senior attorney. He's been around for a long time, done a lot of oil and gas. So that is essentially our legal team. But, you know, much of this stuff is circulated around and passed upstairs. And so a lot of people look at these things. Tina Kobayashi has been involved in a lot of matters, but the essential legal team is six. I know the first argument we had in this case, I walked in with my paralegal, and there were, you know, seven or eight attorneys representing the lessees from all over not all over the country, but Houston, L.A., big name firms and stuff. It was great.
It was you against seven other guys or seven other lawyers.
Oh, we've had cases, these oil and gas cases, where there's many more attorneys than that representing the lessees and the small team.
We are not a finance subcommittee, but you know, do you feel like you have adequate resources to keep the case?
Yes.
Vindicate the state's interests.
Yes.
Sure. Senator Willikowski.
The job you've done is fantastic, and I think on behalf of all Alaskans, I think people greatly appreciate what you're doing. What kind of legal fees has the state expended in this? And did we get any back through Rule 82 or other sources?
Senator Willikowski, through the chairman, we have actually gotten some of our fees back, and on some of the motions that we've won, ExxonMobil filed a a lawsuit against the state and Superior Court for damages, declaratory judgment, injunctive relief, and we succeeded in having that case dismissed, and we were awarded fees in connection with that. However, our fees are very modest. How much have we expended? Let me just confer here for a minute. Can I answer it? The fees incurred on this case have been spectacularly reasonable, and I'm not here to advertise for Ashburn.
I'm not here to say that.
No, I understand, but this is. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
And this is by no means meant to as any type of. I know these cases are very expensive. I'm sure it's probably in the millions. Would be my guess.
No. let me just tell you something. I've seen a lot of stuff representing the state in oil and gas matters. Worked with a number of firms. Seen bills that just couldn't believe. Okay. For the quality and the amount of work we're getting. In this case, we have gotten fabulous work in incredibly reasonable rates, and I'm not sure what our total expenditure is yet but at this stage of the game, but I believe with Ashburn and Mason, we are under, I'm guessing now, but I think it's under $400,000. Mm-hmm. Now, in past experience, I would have expected to be in the millions by now. But also keep in mind that we have a new model here that we're following. Instead of handing the case off to outside counsel, Department of Law retains control of the case. And we work with outside counsel. And and that enables us to control and keep. I just think we get better results, more efficient work, and at a much lower cost. But.
This is a little bit of sort of back to the future. Someone who worked on oil and gas back in the late 80s, where we had a similar process. We were working on corporate income tax worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and we had a team of six or seven Department of Law attorneys with an equivalent or more number of private attorneys. And it turns, that's a fairly reasonable way to go. As budgets have declined in those intervening years, and there was an unwillingness, there's generally been an unwillingness to add personnel to the department, we have had to instead, and our issues have sort of multiplied, we now have, we're often more managing, and there's been more of a willingness to pay for outside counsel than inside counsel. And the problem that we have budget-wise is that it takes $4 for outside counsel for what $1 for our in-house counsel could do. So it is, I think Richard is correct in saying that actually this is a model that it's an old one, but it's one we had gotten away from due to budget necessities, but it is a very efficient one, and money-wise. Maybe you add a few more personnel to the state line, but you don't, you add less dollars to the budget, so.
And I mean, I think we've all heard the stories about the deputy AG who shows up and there's 15 attorneys on the other side. The question was, I mean, whatever amount is spent, it's obviously an investment. We're talking billions of dollars here. It's an investment that needs to be made. But I'm just trying to get a grasp of how much of our resources are being used to fight this sort of, in my opinion, really endless discussion here. And how many hours, do you know how many hours the state has put into this, attorney hours, paralegal hours? Not private, but I mean, I guess from the deputy attorney generals.
Well, yeah, Senator Wilkowski through the chairman, there's been years when I didn't get a weekend off. I mean, that sounds like nonsense. Well, I probably got a few, but there have been years on some of these cases where you work almost every holiday. Now, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm getting too old, and I can't really do it. And I shouldn't get into compensation at this point. But the thing about it is, if you can, how many hours?
Be careful.
Pretty much. I couldn't say full time because we're working on a bunch of other things too. But I would say probably. It varies depending on what's going on. You're preparing a brief, it may be full time. And you're not preparing a brief, you can work on other things. But it's, I would say, a rough approximation, probably Overall, probably 40% of my time, personally. At times it's 100%, but overall, on average, probably 40%.
Senator, I can actually get you the hours when we have those. If you'd like, I can.
I'd be curious.
Other questions for members of the state's legal team? I don't hear or see any. Senator McGuire.
One last one, through the chair. Have you looked at other states as a comparison for how they do their leasing when you're making your arguments? I mean, it's sort of the lease ends up being a creature of contract law primarily, correct?
Yes, Senator McGuire.
And is that the common methodology used by other states?
Leasing? Yes. Yes, it is. But generally speaking, on all these issues, we survey the law. And so through surveying the law, you're exposed to the different types of transactional documents that are used or issues that come up in the types of documents they're using. But we have not, I have not, as far as I know, the team has not gone and actually looked at leases from other jurisdictions, because this case isn't really it's not really about trying to improve the lease. It's sort of dealing with what you have,
yeah,
and trying to get DNR's decision sustained.
And just in follow-up, the only reason I was asking is I thought there might be litigation out there on some of the leases that are based in contract law in other jurisdictions where there was a challenge. And I just thought maybe for persuasive value.
We do survey, again, all the decisions we can find in other jurisdictions about these types of oil and gas contests. So I think the answer to your question would be, to the extent it's about litigation and the issues in the case, would be yes, we have looked at other jurisdictions.
Thank you. Mr. Todd, I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come here to Juneau and give us this briefing. I hope you felt some measure of the appreciation we have for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
I know a lot of what you do is kind of falls under the category of unsung heroes, but on behalf of the rest of the Judiciary Committee, thank you. And with that, we are adjourned.